Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles. I still
remember. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles, broadcasting through our studios in New York, not in studio because I'm on location today. We're going to talk about the latest with a specific Chinese herbal treatment that shows signs of effectiveness with bone marrow recovery. That's a big deal because that's very difficult through Orthodox medicine. This comes from UCLA. Also, how green cabbage microgreens, the little tiny, maybe a quarter of inch high greens, can actually lower the bad LDL cholesterol. This newest Department of Agriculture. Because yesterday I mentioned about how a lot of people are not aware they've got low levels of the LDLs, and they can make them a lot lower because if you got elevated LDLs, you can have a heart attack. But people say, what do I do to lower them? Well, now we're going to give you the answer, something you can eat. Also from the University of Alberta, Faculty of Medicine, avoiding over-the-counter heartburn medications could save cancer patients' lives. Medications for heartburn and gastric issues could lower the possibility of surviving. So, we want to give you the latest on that. And also, from the University of Queensland, vitamin C deficiency in pregnancy is linked to a greater autism risk. And this was a major population-based cohort study. So, I'll share that with you. And there's a science to gift-giving. Experiences are better than material items. University of Toronto. What's that mean? I'll explain how it's not only enjoyable, but remembered afterwards. It allows a whole person's immune system to take a nice step up when you do something with them rather than buying them a sweater that they're going to try to find someone else to wear it. Our guest in the, we have two guests today, the guest in the second part of our program, discussing the failure of American public education and the future challenges to our educational system under the Trump presidency is Professor Diana Ravitch. She's a research professor and historian of education in the Department of Humanities and Social Service at New York University. Her research is largely focused upon the politics and federal policies of education, but from 1991 to 1993, she was Assistant Secretary of Education and has since held board positions on a variety of national education organizations and think tanks. As an educator for over 35 years, and someone who really appreciates old-time teaching, I'm going to offer her some challenging questions about why have we gone so far afield from what the mandate should be, providing students with an environment that allows them to engage in critical thinking skills. Also today, our newsmaker, which will follow Health and Nutrition, is Dr. Gareth Porter. Gareth is an award-winning historian, independent investigative journalist, and policy analyst. And we're going to talk about newsmaking on Syria and Aleppo and why almost all the news that we're getting is fake news. And then once I go through that on Monday's program, I'm devoting 45 minutes with 9 different segments, including people who've been in Aleppo, been in Syria multiple times, spoken with the people, of why there's two completely different stories being told. We'll discuss that in depth. And by the way, they're also challenging Democracy Now! and I believe rightly so. And I'm going to ask and send out a request for Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, to come on and debate the journalist who was in Syria multiple times as to why she believes Democracy Now! Has been promoting a neoliberal agenda in Syria and is wrong on it. So we'll see. I hope that she accepts that invitation. And today I'm going to share some insights on corruption in the CDC. Now, why is that important? Because this is where official health policy, from vaccines to whether or not a particular item in the environment is toxic or not, that all comes from there. And then on the environment. Recently, I made a statement that I believed, in fact, earlier this week, that not to scare anyone, but just to be completely honest, which is the only way I know how to share information. And if you just look at it as information, that's good. So here is what this is going to be about. I said that I believe that 90% of Americans will be adversely affected by global warming, climate change. They wouldn't do anything about it. They don't care about it. They're not going to change. Even in the face of imminent death, they would rather not change. Our government's not going to change. No matter how many panels, no matter how many treaties they sign, it's all voluntary, so it's all nonsense. But then I'm very optimistic, and I'm very positive for the 5 to 10% of Americans, which will be anywhere from, realistically, probably around 30 million Americans who are very aware and are making choices in their life, like going vegan, so that they can help in their own personal and collective way to limit the impact of global warming, where we still have an impact, and even adjusting their lives towards future steps so that they can make a normal, non-rushed, non-panicked, reasonable change to be environments that are more likely to be long-term and sustainable. So there's good news, bad news. And someone stopped me on the street as I was walking up the street on Madison Avenue the other day. He heard that. He said, I listen to your show every day, and I really disagree. I don't see this being that bad, or the media would have covered it. The politicians would be outraged and doing something about it. Not true. I'll start with this from our environmental segment, then segue into health. This is from Common Dreams. Quote, climate change and the coming humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. Military national security experts are sounding the alarm about tens of millions of climate change refugees. Climate change, the result in natural disasters and droughts and sea level rise, quote, could lead to a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. Those are according to senior military figures told to The Guardian yesterday. Specifically, experts echoed a recent warning from the United Nations that without radical action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, quote, we will grieve over the avoidable human tragedy, end quote, as the number of global climate refugees climbs. Quote, we're going to see refugee problems on an unimaginable scale, potentially above 30 million people. And that's according to the Major General, Chairman of the Global Military Advisory Council on Climate Change. And, quote, climate change could lead to a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. We've already seen migration of large numbers of people around the world because of food scarcity, water insecurity, and extreme weather, and this is set to become the new normal. Quote, and it is accelerating instability. Now, how bad is it? Well, not through civil war. That's a separate 7 million people who are flooding Europe and the Mediterranean countries. Oh, by the way, not a single one of the Arab countries that participated in the destruction of Libya and Syria are inviting any of these refugees. Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, In fact, Saudi Arabia has room in specially designed cities, tent cities, with air conditioning and sewer and water. Not a single person's in them. 4 million people could be, zero are. Why hasn't this been news? Why haven't we used this as a method of pressuring the Saudis to do something since they've caused this problem? Oh, I forgot. This is a terrorist country. These are hate mongers. These are people who behead people, kill gays. So how do you go out and talk to the gay community that you're on their side? At the same time, you're funding people to kill gays. I'd like to know how the liberal community spins that concept. Quote, this is separate now. This is natural disasters leading to immigration. And this is from a mainstream of American business, Forbes. Natural disasters displaced 36 million people in the last full year of this study. 20 million moved because of climate change-related factors. And scientists predict that natural disaster-related refugees could increase by as many as 200 million in the upcoming times. So, if we can't house, if we can't feed, if we can't control 6 to 7 million, what are you going to do with 200 million? And that's assuming that America will not have its own refugees. And I predict we're going to have at least 20 to 40 million Americans in the very near future forced to leave where they're living. For example, just today, just as I'm speaking, Corpus Christi, Texas, has water that's undrinkable. So they're telling people, don't drink anything out of your tap or shower. Only drink bottled water. Now, that's Corpus Christi. Now, yesterday, the people of Corpus Christi thought, we don't have a problem. Today, they've got a big problem. And what about all the people in Nevada, where there is no water, except what comes out of the Little Colorado, and that's diminishing in Lake Mead, and that's down to its lowest level in history since it was built, and now they have to build another giant pipe, a pipe large enough for a car to drive through, below the water line, because the one above the water line, water's below it. So they're having to create new ways of getting depreciated water. Why? Because there's not enough snow. Why? Because climate change. Without snow, there's not snowpack. Without snowpack, you don't have the snow melting over a period of 6 months, feeding the rivers, the tributaries, the aquifers, and the irrigation systems. As a result, 40 million people who now rely upon water out of the west are not going to have it. So all I'm saying is I've understated the problem, and I've encouraged people to read the article I wrote, which is free. It's there as a public service. It took us a year to research it. The best sustainable places in America to live. It's up on my website. Now to the latest on health and healing, because there's a lot of good that we can do for ourselves with our health, and that's why I always like to start with something that's doable. For those of you who've gone through the problems of bone marrow recovery, you know that you have to take a series of drugs, and where on one hand the drugs try to encourage the bone marrow to grow, another part of it suppressing much of the immune system. But new research out of UCLA found that a Chinese herbal regimen called TSY1, that's T as in Tom, S in Sam, Y as in you, 1. And that increases telomerase activity in normal blood cells, but decreases it in cancer cells. And telomerase, as you know, if you've listened to this program, it's an enzyme responsible for the production of telomeres, which play an important role in the regulation of normal cell division. And these results indicate that telomerase-based treatments may play an important role in treating both blood cell deficiency and cancer. And more than 80% of cancers have increased telomerase activity, and other medicinal conditions are also associated with a decreased or abnormal telomerase function. So the ability to increase or decrease telomerase activity has very important life outcome for cancer So this is a treatment that works. So pay attention to that. Again, it's TSY1. That is the Chinese herbal regimen. From the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they found that red cabbage microgreens lower your LDL or the bad cholesterol in this experiment. And that was published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry from the American Chemical Society. So my suggestion is, microgreens are very easy to grow. In about 3 weeks from now, I'll be hopefully, if all goes well, helping in a Syrian refugee camp where I'll be spending quite some time to help the health of the children, pregnant women, and to become more self-sustaining. I'm going to see that they get food, and but also, more importantly, how to grow their own food. And the one thing I'm going to get them growing immediately, once I show them how to construct it, and I'll be constructing it for them and showing them, is all the microgreens and sprouts. So this way, they'll have at least 100 different items that they could grow on a daily basis, where you actually can harvest them within anywhere from 3 to 7 days. And microgreens take a little longer, up to maybe 20 days, but that's a very short period of time compared to 3 months for an average vegetable. But inside those little tiny microgreens are powerhouses of nutrition, chlorophyll, nutrients, antioxidants, enzymes, phytonutrients, loaded with these. You could grow these on your own counter in your home. Just get a tray, a simple sprouting tray, and the way you would grow any other sprout, you grow microgreens the same way. And you can get organic, non-genetically engineered seeds through Seeds of Change. Even Johnny's Seeds has organic seeds. So that can lower your the LDL cholesterol. I suggest using one cup full of sprouts in every salad every day. From University of Alberta, the Faculty of Medicine, don't use those over-the-counter heartburn meds because if you have cancer, it can kill you. Quote, something as seemingly as harmless as a heartburn pill could lead cancer patients to take a turn for the worse. A University of Alberta study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Oncology discovered that proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, which are very common medications for heartburn and gastrointestinal bleeding, decrease effects of a type of chemotherapy usually prescribed to gastric cancer patients. The study by Department of Oncology's Michael Sayre and their team looked at 500 patients, and the results were conclusive. The PPIs affected progression-free survival by more than a month. The overall survival in cancer patients was reduced by more than 2 months, and the disease control rate by 11. So, if you want to live a longer life, and you are on cancer therapies, stay away from the heartburn meds. Now, if you want to overcome heartburn, two of the most common reasons we have heartburn in America is coffee. The caffeine in coffee and the coffee phytonutrients hit the hydrochloric acid in the stomach and then cause a hyperacidic reaction, which causes you to regurgitate through the stomach up into the esophagus. And that causes an increase in extreme inflammation of the esophagus, and esophageal cancer is the number one increase in cancer in the Western nations. So get rid of that. Separately, when you're taking aspirin, it also causes bleeding and severe inflammation in the stomach and in the intestine. Over 25,000 people die every year from taking aspirin, mainly to thin their blood. If you want to thin their blood, vitamin C thins your blood, vitamin E thins your blood very easily and safely, plus helps your overall health condition. So that's the latest in health and nutrition. I'm Gary Noll, and we're going to go right over now to our guest to talk about something that is not getting the attention it deserves from the mainstream or alternative media. Dr. Gareth Porter is my guest. He's an award-winning historian, an independent investigative journalist, and a policy analyst specializing in U.S. geopolitics and national security issues. And by the way, during the Vietnam War, he was dispatched new service bureau chief in Saigon and later co-director for the Indochina Resource Center. He specializes in Vietnamese and Cambodian affairs. He's reported from the Middle East. He has published in Foreign Affairs, Al Jazeera, Huffington, Counterpunch, Truthout, Consortium News. Interesting, because that would make you up on that deadly blacklist, the new McCarthy. So are we to accept that you are a card-carrying communist?
Well, that would be the implication that certain people might place on it. But I think, as you know very well, that list has been so totally discredited that I'm not particularly worried about it.
Good for you. In fact, if there's anything, at least 50 of the sources of those 200 organizations that they're now trying to implicate as the creators of fake news are the purveyors of accurate news and the challengers of fake news. And by implication, the people such as Cornel West and people who tell the truth, Chris Hedges, they would be also implicated. So I look at this as one broad brush sweep of trying to discredit people who are known to be uncompromising in telling the truth. And the mainstream media, sponsored by the Washington Post and the New York Times, can't handle that. Now, there's a great discrepancy between what the mainstream media is telling us about events about the liberation of Aleppo by Syria and Russian forces, and what we're witnessing on the ground by witnesses there, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and Democracy Now! And all the mainstream papers and some alternative are painting a picture of devastation and death by the Assad government, claiming that they're lining people up and killing them, that they're killing people who are trying to leave. And yet I've been looking at video after video after video of people taking to the streets with thousands of people cheering and applauding the fact that for the first time in more than 4 years, they've actually been liberated. So instead of putting this as a liberation of Aleppo, the whole mainstream media is looking at it as the destruction of Aleppo. Could you explain this, of why we're seeing such two completely different approaches to this?
Sure. This is a very interesting case study in how news gets made in the corporate media. Because what we're seeing, and what we have seen really for months now, is a very intensive campaign, a propaganda campaign that has been waged by a core of sources, mainly people that are call themselves activists, many of whom also call themselves journalists in Aleppo, and who are in fact working on behalf of the regime in East Aleppo, and indeed the broader regime over northern Syria, which is of course dominated pretty much completely by Al-Qaeda, by the what we used to call Al-Nusra Front, is indeed clearly the most powerful single political military force in that part of Syria. And so, for example, the White Helmets are, as I think many of your listeners know very well, is a highly celebrated organization which was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for their rescue efforts in situations that have involved bombing and destruction of structures. But the same White Helmets also have fulfilled a propaganda purpose, a PR public information purpose for on behalf of this Al-Qaeda dominated regime in East Aleppo. And I investigated very thoroughly and uncovered a series of outright lies by the head of the White Helmets in East Aleppo, and indeed in Aleppo province generally, in regard to the convoy, the aid convoy attack in September of this year. which of course was almost universally, I shouldn't say almost, it was universally blamed on the Russian airplanes and Assad regime aircraft by the corporate media, based almost entirely, I would say, on the say-so of the Pentagon without offering any real evidence, and the White Helmet people who were, by some strange coincidence, actually right there on the scene at the time that it happened and offered their first-person testimony. And what I was able to show in my piece published at Alternet was that virtually everything that was said by the head of the White Helmets in Aleppo was false, and it could be verified as false if you really check the record carefully, and some of it was simply a matter of contradicting himself. So, I mean, this is one part of a much broader pattern of propaganda being put out quite consciously by people who are working under the authority of al-Qaeda in northern Syria in general and East Aleppo in particular. And these are the people who have been the sources of these stories about lining up women and children and shooting them and shooting at refugees trying to leave and so forth. And as you say, there has been no visual evidence. There has been no specific evidence that could be verified. And it is all not just highly suspect, but must be treated as almost 100% certainty as being propaganda.
We must also mention that we now have substantial proof that the United States and our allies have supported the White Helmets to the tune of between $50 to $100 million, and they always seem to be exactly there to get front page or mainstream coverage by Al Jazeera and the other networks. But the people who have been there and who are telling a different story, they say there's only one doctor left in East Aleppo and there's no anesthesia. And yet other sources say they frequently conflate the issues, they lie about the statistics. And a group of doctors came forward showing that there were many doctors and there was medicine, and there was actually an opportunities, 8 different routes to get out of East Aleppo. And the terrorists, what I call terrorists, I don't believe in calling them moderate terrorists, because I don't believe there is such a thing as moderate terrorism, but al-Nusra or al-Qaeda affiliates or ISIS affiliates, they were killing the people trying to leave. None of this was covered by the American press in a fairly or honestly objective way. They told one side of the story, not looking at it honestly. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. This is a remarkable case study in the in sort of covering a particular issue entirely in a one-sided way, and indeed covering it in a way that is dictated by people who are really working on behalf of an organization, a set of organizations that have been regarded, I think, appropriately as an enemy, a threat to the security of Americans, because of their record of terrorism, efforts at carrying out terrorist acts against the United States. So, I mean, this is a huge story that needs to be told, that has been suppressed, and indeed has been turned into a completely different sort of story by the U.S. media. And I'm glad you mentioned the Washington Post, because, you know, it has been at the center, along with the New York Times, of this sort of one-sided, completely distorted coverage of what has been happening in Syria for many, many months.
Final issue. Oh, by the way, one little addendum. They are great at propagandizing. There's a little girl. I don't know how old she is. I'm guessing 4 to 5 years old. She ends up being in multiple places at the same time and with the same name. She has a Facebook following of 287,000, and she's pleading, this may be my last day, you know. And then you get the same group of 5 or 6 people, all of whom have Facebooks, all of whom are part of this movement, and yet no one in the media who have the resources to verify it have looked into their backgrounds, to see who are they really representing. Are these really the citizens of East Aleppo? Turns out none of them are. These are all staged interviews. And in one interview that no one thought would be seen, there was actually a white helmet person standing on the body of a Syrian soldier that he killed. So are they there to kill the soldiers in the daytime and help the people of East Aleppo at night? It is not a story that is on any level been told honestly. That was just a little addendum. But my final question is, when you look at what we're doing in Iraq and with Mosul, where America and Iraqi forces and militias, Shia militias, are trying to liberate Mosul, you see it completely changing the script. There we are liberating the city, we are heroes, and if there's dead in the process, well, you know, they died for greater cause, the liberation. No one is condemning America or the Shia or the militias, and totally opposite of Syria. Could you explain this, please?
Well, it's not easy to explain, because what you're referring to here, what you're alluding to, is a very interesting pattern in U.S. policy in the Middle East, whereby, on one hand, in Iraq, the United States is de facto allies with Iran and the Shia militias there, and in Syria, the United States treats Iran as an adversary and indeed a dangerous enemy, and no one ever bothers to try to explain to the American people how this is the case, because they can't. I mean, how can this be? And this is a reflection, of course, of the broader problem that U.S. policy in the Middle East is simply a matter of the bureaucratic interests of the Pentagon and the CIA. And I won't go into detail about this, but I have written about it a number of times, that what has happened in the Obama administration is simply that the CIA wanted its war against Assad. It wanted to have its covert operation to support the opposition to Assad, and it didn't matter what their background was, whether they were Al-Qaeda or not. They were perfectly happy to do that. The Pentagon, on the other hand, wanted its war against ISIS, and so you get this contradiction in U.S. policy, which is never explained and which can't be explained except in terms of this real truth that U.S. policy has been a matter of the bureaucratic self-interest of these powerful national security bureaucracies, the most powerful bureaucracies the world has ever known.
And sharing these newsmaker insights when we have nothing but one side of the story covered by the mainstream media, this is a breath of fresh air, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Working in a coal mine, going down.
In the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?
Daddy, working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine.
I'd like to welcome all of you. We're going to go to our guests in just about 4 minutes from now. I just want to take a moment to share a couple of program announcements with you. I have a really powerful show lined up for Monday. People you've never heard before telling the truth from on the ground in Syria about how everything you've been told by the American media are lies. So you'll have a chance to hear the record being set straight. Also, Monday evening at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I'm going to be having a screening of a documentary on overcoming depression and anxiety, and then a webinar dealing with loneliness. It doesn't mean we're lonely only around the holidays. A lot of people walk around lonely for different reasons. And that does impact the quality of your life, in fact, even the length of life. So I'm going to put a different view on loneliness, try to give you some positive information, as I try to do with everything where there's a problem, showing the program. So go to prn.fm, that's prn.fm, which means progressiveradionetwork.com, or if you forget either of those, go to garynoll.com. You'll see how you can get to the Monday evening program. Please don't wait till Monday evening because you won't get on. Every single one of my webinars sell out. They're packed, and I answer the questions that people have. You'll see, and it's really a lot of fun, and we've broadened our wavelength so that bandwidth, so more people can watch it. We're up to a maximum now, but even the maximums are generally exceeded. So if you want to deal with loneliness and depression, anxiety, Monday evening, 7 p.m. That way people all over the world can watch it. Also, I'm helping to raise some funds for our sister station, and I set aside 1 week and 1 week only, the 8th of January, in a beautiful environment, warm climate, to have a health retreat. And these health retreats, if you've never been to them, they are so enjoyable. What can you expect? You can expect to get positive people coming from around America as our staff, the chef, vegan food, cooking classes, juicing, nutrition, growing classes, homesteading classes. I do a 2 to 3 hour lecture every night. Luann Panessi does counseling. We have yoga and meditation and art and water aerobics and biking. Oh, you name it, we're doing it. Plus as much time just to chill out and relax as you want. So we keep it small so that everybody gets attention. We just ask people to ask yourself a basic question. Do you believe that you are deserving of a week to change your life, to help you de-stress, detoxify, rejuvenate, and have a plan going forward? So if you believe that you deserve it, well, then give Luann a call. Luann's on the phone now. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Yeah, we actually were full up, and as sometimes happens, we had a couple of cancellations. So if people are ready to take that next step in their life, they're ready to make some fundamental changes, and they want to be in a beautiful environment to start off the new year, give me a call. I make sure that I interview everyone to make sure it's the right event for you. Give me a call. I'm at 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. Give me a call, and I'll look forward to seeing everyone there.
Good. Thank you, Luann. So, again, I've seen people change. Now, I'm going to ask our engineer. I'm not in studio today because I'm trying to complete my filming of this new documentary I'm working on. Do you have a clip, just to give an example from the last retreat that we did, so that people can... Let's hear from some of the people who were there. Short clip.
Hello, I'm KB, and I cannot put into words the amazing and wonderful experience here at Gary Noel's retreat. I came here physically debilitated and today I feel 90% better. I'm able to do what I could not do before. I have participated in a race that I never imagined I would have been able to take part in. I would have never had the courage had I not come. I've learned so much, and now I want to be a viable part of my community as a result of the information I've gotten here. This is better than any vacation I could have ever taken anywhere in the world, and I've traveled the world. Now I know that life is about living, and I've learned how to do so here at this retreat. Thank you.
My husband asked me to tell to say some things about his experiences here at the retreat this week. He wants to tell you that 5 years ago he was afflicted with a very devastating disease, and he hung up his tennis racket and his running shoes. Sorry. Last year, he was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And when we arrived at the retreat, he really felt that he could hardly do the first day, one lap plus three laps on the running track. But during the course of this week, he's gone from that to doing 18 laps today without trouble. And he's played tennis twice, and he's never felt better in his life or in 5 years. It's been a magic bullet, though he didn't think there was a magic bullet.
My name is Carol. I'm on my first retreat, and I came because of a very serious health challenge that I am facing. And I am not the kind of person that gives up. I was very close, I think, to, I don't want to say giving up, but not really knowing a direction that I thought could help me. And I have found a tremendous amount of help right here. I came here not believing that I could walk a mile and a half, and now I know that I can walk much more than that. I know that I will get off this oxygen. In fact, I've been off of it for the last couple of days. I was unable to climb stairs at a reasonable pace, and now I can climb stairs normally and get there without getting short of breath. Let's see what else is different. Gary did some energy work on me the other day, and I discovered that I could not follow his meditative direction. I could not make the light go through me. However, in spite of that, the pain in my right side that I used to describe myself as being the old shoe that was given to the teething puppy, because I felt like I was just being chewed up and torn apart. There's no more biting. I still have pain, but that horrible pain is gone and has been since he did that work. And I will be eternally grateful for that. It makes me want to go on. And I made a list of things that I'm going to take with me to implement from this retreat. One, of course, is daily exercise. Number two is minimization of the psychobabble that comes from my TV.
Mind you, that last woman, I never know what anyone has when they come. But I've seen so many things happen that's positive in people's journey through life. She was on a respirator, and she couldn't walk. She was in a wheelchair. She had end-stage disease. And by the end of the week, she was walking and without the respirator, and you'd never known anything was wrong. She's still alive and getting healthier. So good things happen. Good energy abounds. Give Luann a call, and Luann, give your number one last time, please.
Yes, it's 903-881-7008. And by the way, that woman called me the other day. She's walking 5 miles a day religiously, and she feels terrific.
Remember when she arrived, she couldn't get out of the chair.
No, she was in the wheelchair, and she was attached to oxygen all day. And by the second day, she took off the oxygen, she started walking, and she never looked back.
So you got to believe in the positive elements of life and that you deserve it. All right, now we're going to call our guest, and while our guest is getting on the line, I just want to let you know the grape stuff is back in inventory at a great price. So we've been out for a while, so call 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
put your arms around me. I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, and joining us in New York City via Skype is Professor Diane Ravitch. And I gave you her bio a little earlier in the program, so let's go over and say hello to her. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. I feel we should begin with a hard look at America's educational system and the trends in educational reform that have been underway for the past 15 to 20 years. Increasingly, standardized testing failed to prepare and educate children for the future, just as the standard American diet has contributed to disease. The No Child Left Behind, in my personal opinion, under Bush administration, was a disaster and never reached its goals. And the floodgates of charter schools and the privatization solely for profit incentives, in my opinion, has dumbed down education even further. And a big question is whether or not this is accidental, or are these reforms an intentional act of design to further the gap between the privileged who can afford an excellent education and everyone else who will simply amass into a corporate workplace? And then, finally, there is a great threat of our public educational system being transferred into a free market capitalist system. And at one time, you were an advocate for some of these testing agendas. Then I believe that later you severed yourself and joined the opposition. At least that's what I have been led to believe. You can define that when you answer. But based upon that decision, what is it that you were witnessing in educational reform policies at the federal level and the trends underway in a standardized national educational system that disturb you the most? The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. You've given a good summary of what's going on in this country and has been for about the past at least 16 years. George W. Bush brought in No Child Left Behind, and as you said, it has been a disaster. It has demoralized teachers. It's put a tremendous emphasis on high-stakes testing. It has undermined real education, where children have time to read and think and reflect and show some critical thinking skills, because testing has been made the measure of everything. I think that the rise of testing and privatization is not an accident. They go together. The reason that people like Jeb Bush and George W. Bush, and so many of these people who call themselves reformers love high-stakes testing is that their purpose was to make the public schools look bad. They use the phrase achievement gap, which refers to the test score differences between, say, rich kids and poor kids, and between black students and white students, and between other groups. They use this achievement gap rhetoric very cynically to say, well, the public schools haven't eliminated the difference in test scores, so they're failing. And so we have to test them more, make the test harder. That's what the Common Core was about. The Common Core was introduced in 2010, in that era, and the standards were so difficult and so, in some sense, incoherent, and the tests accompanying them were so hard that suddenly everyone in the country, in every state in the union, most kids were failing. This is ridiculous. I mean, our public school system deals with kids from all strata of life, and it has the largest number ever of kids living in poverty. A report from the Southern Education Foundation said last year that now we have about half the kids in public schools in some area of poverty. And poverty is the surest predictor of test scores on standardized tests. So when we see low scores, you can be sure the low scores represent schools and districts where there's high poverty. But we have now this movement, the privatization movement, which calls itself the reform movement. They really are not reformers. They're privatizers. And the privatizers use the test scores to say, well, since the scores are low, we must have vouchers, we must have charters. And the charter movement, unfortunately, was supported by the Obama administration. It was very seldom that Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, ever pointed to a successful public school. He loved to point to charter schools and say it was miracle school, even though the charter schools were free to accept the students they wanted, free to kick out the ones they didn't want, and we're now developing a dual school system. The charter schools, which take the kids they want and kick out those they don't want, and the public schools, which are left with to take all of those rejected by charter schools. So the Obama administration and the big foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Eli Broad Foundation, the Walton Foundation, these are all billionaire foundations. They have been all in for privatizing public schools through charters, and they've laid the groundwork for the Trump administration, and Trump has selected as his privatizer-in-chief billionaire Betsy DeVos from Michigan. So that's a short summary, and there's more to be said about all of this, of course.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. Earlier this year, you wrote an article arguing that every child should opt out of standardized testing because they are meaningless. Further explain that, please, and explain why standardized testing is dumbing down youth's ability for critical thinking and independent decision-making. And what is the consequence at the end of the day for, let's say, two students with two teachers? One, teaching the old-fashioned way, the way you and I probably both grew up learning, how to become critical thinkers, how to evaluate, deconstruct, how to analyze information. And the other today is study, study, test, study, study, test. But what about all the other elements of the educational process that should create critical thinking that is, seems to be devoid? And yet both can say, well, we went through school, we got our degrees, or we graduated. A whole lot difference in how they're going to face the issues of life and knowing whether or not the information they're exposed to on a daily basis is objective or not, accurate or not, or even important for them or not.
Standardized testing has dumbed down education. There's a role for standardized testing. Teachers should be able to use standardized tests and not have this information transferred over to the central office. It should be available to say, this child needs more or less of something. The problem with standardized testing today, particularly when it is one of the standardized tests funded by the federal government, is the teachers don't even learn how their students performed. All they get is a ranking of the students. And so the students are told, you failed, you're in the 30th percentile, or you're above you're in the 40th, whatever percentile it is. So there's no information, there's no diagnostic value to the test. And that's why I said they're utterly meaningless, because there's no feedback to teachers, there's no feedback to students, and simply a ranking. It's like a letter grade or a number that has no relationship to helping students or helping teachers do a better job. What we have today is a standardized testing industry that's a multi-billion dollar industry that has nothing to do with education. Someone somewhere has written questions. The students are given these questions, and whether they know that information or not, that determines whether they're going to be labeled a success or a failure. And there's so much more to life than having a standardized test written by someone from Pearson or one of the other big companies. And teachers are the best judges of whether their students are progressing. So what standardized testing has done is it's narrowed the curriculum, because anything that's not tested is not important. So the only things that are tested are reading and math skills. So that means that history is not important, science is not important, musical ability and the arts are not important. Physical education is not important. And so there are schools across the country that have given up on recess in elementary school, eliminated physical education, or put physical education, believe it or not, online. Florida has online physical education. And there are schools that are simply skipping other crucial studies, and particularly the arts. The arts are the first to go, because the test scores have become all-consuming. So there's a narrowing of the curriculum. There's also an inducement on the part of schools and principals and teachers to find some way to help the kids get higher scores, not necessarily to be better educated, but to get higher scores. That's led to cheating scandals, and we've seen these cheating scandals across the country. The reason for this is because we have the closure of schools being tied to test scores. And thousands of schools across the country have been closed and replaced by charter schools, which are privately managed. and which in many states are either have no accountability or grade their own test. I learned just this week that one of the charter chains in New York City is exempt from the state regents exam. That's the high school graduation exam. And there's no reason to exempt them other than political power. So unfortunately, whether it's the Gates Foundation or any of these other big foundations, they have poured their resources into creating a privatized system in which some people are making millions and millions of dollars, certainly the test makers, but also charter owners who are making millions of dollars on real estate transactions.
My final question is, the big concern right now among educational reform advocates, such as yourself and others, on the progressive side of the educational debate, is Trump's appointment of Betty DeVos to be his Secretary of Education. Now, aside from being another of Trump's billionaire nominees, and by the way, I just found a statistic this morning that Trump's cabinet, at least the 13 current appointments, have more wealth than 40% of the entire American population combined. That's an extraordinary concept when you think about it. She also belongs to that faction of evangelical Christians who desire the entire nation and planet, for that matter, to embrace Jesus, and her approach to education is one of a crusade. And
right.
Nobody's even mentioning in the news that her brother, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, the mercenary corporation, now called Academia, and she is a strong supporter of for-profit educational models rather than schools being a universal right for children in a modern society. So please tell us more about Betty DeVos and what her educational platform is. And as a businesswoman, philanthropist, and educational activist in the state of Michigan, where many of her educational policies have been adopted, what is the condition of education in Michigan? And because she's bragged that she never attended public school, she doesn't have any advanced degrees, her children didn't attend public school, and she's been against it. And she's against unions, and hence against union school teachers. And this is the person running our educational system? It seems an extremely inappropriate choice. Your thoughts?
Well, it's Betsy DeVos, and Betsy and Dick DeVos, her husband, are billionaires, and she's not a businesswoman. Her family were billionaires, and she married into a family of billionaires. So I doubt that she's ever actually worked a day in her life, unless you consider being the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party some kind of a job. She is the first secretary since the department was established in 1980 who is actively and aggressively hostile to public education. She runs an organization called the American Federation for Children, where she's chairman or has been chairman for many years. She founded it. She also has political PACs. And the purpose of both her PACs and the American Federation for Children is to promote vouchers and privatization. And where they can't have vouchers, they have charters. So in Michigan, for example, she and her husband sponsored an amendment to the state constitution in the year 2000, because the Michigan state constitution, as in many states, prohibits the use of public funds for religious schools. So they tried to change that, and it was defeated by a vote of 70-30, actually 69-31, overwhelmingly defeated. And so they then turned to charter schools, and Michigan is overrun with charter schools right now, and 80% of the charters in Michigan operate for profit. The other thing is that Detroit has been her petri dish, and Detroit has many, many charter schools, and most of them were worse than the woebegone public schools. There is a national testing program. It's done on a sampling basis. It's been around since the early 1970s. It's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and it's run by the federal government. On the National Assessment of Educational Progress, Detroit is the lowest performing city in the country. And yet Detroit has, as I said, it's Betsy DeVos's petri dish, and it's been a disaster. The other thing she did was to stop a bill in the Michigan legislature to create accountability for charter schools. She wants a free market with no accountability and privatization for education. The only countries that have tried this are Chile and Sweden, and they're both rapidly trying to backtrack. Chile adopted the Milton Friedman free market approach to education under the dictator Pinochet. Sweden adopted it some years in the 1990s under a conservative regime. Sweden saw its scores on international tests plummet, and they also saw extremes of segregation, because any choice program creates segregation. Whites go in one direction, blacks in another. People segregate by religion, by ethnicity, by all sorts of dimensions. But the destruction of the public education system is a terrible goal to have. It's one of the foundations of our democracy. And we need to improve our public schools and transform them into what they ought to be, which is a good school in every neighborhood and every zip code. And instead, Donald Trump has put the privatizer in chief in charge of the education department. And she's very likely to be confirmed because the DeVoses give so much money to the Republican Party. And prominent Republicans have already said they're delighted with her appointment. Well, she's there to destroy public education. And we have to be watch very carefully and at the state level, block her wherever possible, or we will lose public education.
And of course, one way to do that is becoming aware in your reign of error, the hoax of privatization movement and the danger to America's public schools is an important tool in that journey. Thank you very much, Diane, for being with us today. I appreciate you being on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh.